Thundergrunt.
Good day, Bob.
Bob?
We're going to go around and introduce ourselves, but first, welcome to Writer's Blockbusters. We're the show that treats the final edit of a movie like it's the script. All right, now introduce yourself.
I am Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and full-time script consultant, and my Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
I am Jamie Nash, and I am a screenwriter. I also have a book out. I have a couple books out. Go check them out. One is The 44 Rules of Amateur Sleuthing, great for a Christmas present. Go buy it today. And I'm at Jamie_Nash.
And I'm right. And I am Bob Rose. I'm at Thundergrunt Bob on Twitter. And yeah, I'm happily alive. How's that? I'm not going to plug anything. All right. So today we're going to talk about a movie by some unknown filmmaker.
Yeah, nobody knows.
Nobody knows, and nobody has a problem with. And that's what makes it so important. We're going to talk about Knives Out.
Yes.
Yeah, Rian Johnson.
That's
out. Right.
Yeah, Ryan.
Ryan.
Yeah, even a simple name is complicated.
Yeah, you know. Us with the names.
I did that because I know Jamie was going to have
you.
To say
Thank
it. So I took the hit of the Rian.
Rian.
Which I think on our Last Jedi episode, I made that mistake several times.
Yeah, it just kept coming up.
I just kept saying it right. So
I have a weird factoid about Rian Johnson.
Yes.
This isn't that weird. Born in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Really?
Yeah. So he's local to our neck of the woods?
That's what it says in the IMDb. I've never heard that before.
Wow. Yeah.
So we're in Baltimore, if you didn't know. So yeah, we're
that's
not
exciting
that
for us.
Yeah.
It is.
So that means, like, during Christmas, he's not that far away. Him? He might come home.
Yeah. Him, Mike Flanagan, will all have a party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big party.
Yeah. The Writers Blockbusters guys and those two, equal footing as far as fame and talent. And
guys, did you listen to our podcast?
No, never. No. Yeah. Jamie, who wrote this shit?
Rian Johnson. Rian Johnson, Silver Spring birthplace person.
Rian Johnson, Silver Spring.
Is there a backstory to the development of this, like when it was in comparison to Last Jedi and all that, or is it
I didn't do a huge deep dive
Neither
on it, but because I think there is a little bit of a reaction to Last Jedi.
Okay, like,
there's literally a character in this movie that's a reaction to Last Jedi.
Yeah,
if you can guess which one that is.
Which one is that?
Come on,
you're gonna say it and I'll be like, oh yeah,
the little Nazi kid.
Oh yeah, that totally, with the kids with the Twitter.
Yeah, the kids with the Twitter. He's obviously like, he would
that
be a Last
sense.
Jedi hater. And
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that was obviously
the little jab. Yeah.
Now, whether that came later in the script, we can't know.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, he added it. But
I do wish I knew. I didn't do a deep dive. I think I saw some initial interviews that kind of hinted at a reaction, but that could have been more the reporters angling.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this was like some long gestating project that he eventually made, you know, even before Last Jedi or not. I really don't know. I won't lie.
Because it's like a full circle. The Brick is a, you know, mystery.
Yeah, Brick is a murder mystery,
like and I guess Looper has elements of mystery to it.
And then Brothers Bloom kind of has some stylized tonal stuff that's familiar.
Like it's kind of his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
More than the what he's now known for.
Yeah.
That's more than a space opera.
Looper might be the oddball in that group.
Yeah,
you're
right.
Kind of feels like an M. Night kind of thing or something.
I still think he's defined in my brain by Brick.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
Like that's how I think back of him. Yeah. And this kind of seems like the tonal sequel to Brick.
Yeah, it's like Brick with
he has money and power.
And
power with Brick. Yeah.
Budget.
Budget. Famous people. Everything. Not that Joseph Gordon-Levitt's not famous, but
Brick was engaging, and Brick's a movie, if you haven't seen it, you should go check it out. I'm constantly recommending that movie, especially, you know, we're all independent filmmakers, no-budget filmmakers, and Brick feels closest to something we could have pulled off, even though it is probably, I don't know what it cost, probably $1 million, $500,000, whatever it cost. But It's a movie that's maybe very stylized.
Maybe even like 100,000.
I don't know.
Yeah. You think no?
I bet it still costs 500 to a million, okay, just because that's the way movies are.
Right.
You, could you have made that movie for 50,000? Yes.
Probably.
Yes.
On
yes.
a cell phone now, probably.
It probably wouldn't look, yeah. it probably wouldn't look quite as good no, or no. the sound, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt might have not done it because yeah. he wanted a better lunch.
But he
lunch.
Also kind of wasn't Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
He wasn't.
Just,
that was
yeah,
the one
right.
that was pushing him.
Yeah, yeah. right, yeah. right.
But definitely it was, I know, and I'm going to speak without doing research here. who's the guy who did May, the movie May? Lucky McGee?
Lucky McGee.
Yeah. I know he was in his circle. Like, they were all buds.
Oh,
and he, like, produced maybe May and some of the other. Maybe he was involved in those movies, okay. Rian Johnson. And but the reason I know this is I was, like, a big fan of that. I wanted to be those guys
yeah.
back when May and Brick came out. Like, that's what I wanted to do. So when those movies came out, both of those movies were huge to me. I was like, this is what I want to be doing.
Yeah.
I want to make movies on the cheap that are cool and they're a little different and they're a little subversive. So
clever
they were in a
beyond
circle.
Their budget.
Yes.
Yeah.
Clever
yes.
beyond their budget.
Yeah. Yeah.
At a time when that was accepted and championed, unlike now where it's kind of, I don't know, it's harder to find these movies.
Yeah.
You know, like this.
They're
well,
getting less
like
chances.
Out.
Would Brick
it feels
just,
like.
Brick probably would have been dumped on Amazon Prime and like 10 people would have been like, you got to see this. It's pretty good. And then no one believed it. Yeah. No one watched it. And then, yeah.
Right.
So sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it led to him being a big director.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it did kind of, it was effective. Yeah. Right. Let's not shit on Brick.
I should
shit a brick no, too I much.
I should say that this movie shares a DP with a little movie called Altered. Now available on DVD.
Does it really?
Who yeah. wrote Altered, Jamie?
By Jamie Nash. Written by Jamie Nash. right. Directed by Eduardo Sanchez. I don't know. Who's this voice I'm doing?
So you're twice removed from Rian Johnson.
I am. Now, that same DP was the DP of Last Jedi.
So about that?
He's Rian Johnson's guy.
And
man.
Jimmy, that means Steve that Yedlin. We're three times removed from Rian Johnson.
Okay.
There you go.
If you count podcasts as a project...
Show up at the family house at Christmas.
Silver Spring, let's
local
do it.
Local guys.
We do a podcast with the guy who wrote Altered. What's up, Mom, Dad? So what's the log line of this movie, guys?
We got a workshop.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. Because, okay, one thing I loved that people, it's so simple. Everyone's like, it's not a whodunit. It's yes. a howdunit.
Mm.
I think that
how done it.
I think that serves
as opposed to why done it, the Blake Snyder thing. Why done it is the thing.
But don't you think it's a how done it?
I don't know what it is.
I don't know.
Jamie,
well,
you were going.
We know the why. The why would be in the log line.
So
it's all about money, right?
So here's the
right.
trick.
Yeah.
Here's the trick this movie has. You the trailer and stuff. You see, kind of feels a little Clue in some ways. It feels style. I mean, just stylized. It's these heightened personalities. It's an interesting mansion. Clue was a spoof, of course.
And we've seen these movies before.
We've seen them before.
So kind of go in like, oh, that's one of them. It's,
not
a,
as much,
it's like a genre entry.
Not as much recently. Something that happened more in the 70s and the 60s. Mm-hmm. And
oddly
like
not enough, Ready or Not came out earlier. Mm-hmm. And that is not a murder mystery.
Okay.
But it was very much one of those kind of Brown in a Mansion what's
yes.
going on movies.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think of like Gosford Park back
yeah,
in the day.
Yeah,
and things
yeah, right,
like that.
Right.
You know,
yes.
it's like these...
just saw that.
This one's a little more, and they kind of have a silliness, a funness, a playfulness to these Agatha Christie things where murder is almost fun in some ways.
They have that the British dry wit.
Yeah, they do.
You know?
Yeah.
Toni Collette's hamming it up,
and
Jamie Lee Curtis is there doing some new character, and, you know, it's kind of fun. But anyway, so this movie's a bit of a trick, though. That's what it came out as. And the log line on IMDb plays into the trick.
Okay.
Here's the log line on IMDb. A detective investigates the death of a patriarch of an eccentric, combative family.
Mm. And the detective is probably the biggest star currently
in the movie.
So that's why you tailor it from a marketing standpoint that way.
I think it's
James
Bond
solves
a
mystery.
I think it's also part of the trick. So the movie gets you there.
Are you saying because he's not?
He's not,
not
the protagonist.
He's not the protagonist.
Yeah.
Right.
So the movie then becomes about this other person. Spoiler.
Well, anyone listening, all our episodes are all spoilers.
Yes.
You can never go into this show without a spoiler.
But this movie in particular, this is not a movie you want to see if it's been spoiled for you.
Yeah, no way.
It's the fun of it is the twists and turns. So I just here. So for me, log lines are a hero with a goal. There's an obstacle in the way, and there's life or death stakes if they don't get the obstacle. So for me,
for this movie, that is such a hard right. Well,
for me, the hero is the nurse. What's her name?
Marta.
And she's the hero. Her goal is to keep them from finding out her secret. Mm-hmm. And the life or death stakes is her either getting arrested or her family being deported. Her
right.
mother.
There it is.
I would go with it's all there. Her goal is not to go to jail, or the goal would be like a negative. Like, it is not to be deported.
Well, I think that's the reward.
You think that's the reward?
That's the stakes.
I think that's the stakes.
Okay.
The goal is to prevent the discovery of the truth.
Right.
Which is your classic mystery goal.
That's right. You're right.
It's kind of like goal and stakes. And if you angled it out, like, and I kind of angled one out off the top of my head. After a patient, and this is really long and winded because it has to be, but after a patient commits suicide to cover up her medical accident, I don't know, horrible, a nurse must prevent a world-class detective from figuring out what happened to save herself and her immigrant family from being deported.
That's it.
Something like that.
That is it.
And it's very accurate, but as a log line for marketing, it's awful.
It's awful.
Yes.
It's absolutely atrocious.
Awful. Yes. No. But it also plays to the subversion of
it does. Yeah, subversion. Right.
Now, here's the danger. If you're writing a spec and you have to play this game, it gets really dangerous. So this is why things with twists are risky when you write them. Because let's say you had to pitch. Let's say you were going to pitch and all you get to pitch is the log line. And you had to pitch a detective investigates the death of a patriarch of an eccentric combative family. That's a really boring pitch. You know, I'm like,
right.
Well, what else? What makes it interesting?
Right.
And you can't say, well, it has Daniel Craig because you're a spec screenwriter.
Right.
Right, right.
So it's really hard to pitch that. And it's something that it's execution dependent almost.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's execution dependent. But in this one in particular, it's not like I'd buy it. I'm like, I don't care the script. I'm buying it for the idea.
Well, the whole thing is like the movie's in the word investigates.
Yes.
That's the movie. And you got to be like, well, I trust that you have 90 pages that are really interesting about investigating, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So what's interesting about this concept is the subversion, is the fact that we're promising you one thing and we're going to trick you and give you this other thing. I think that's what's interesting about the movie conceptually. So it's hard.
Which is also a trick being played on the characters themselves.
It is.
Right.
It
is. Yeah.
So if I recommended this movie to somebody, I'd say, don't read anything about it. Just go see it. That would kind of be my.
Yep.
So it's almost a word of mouth kind of movie.
I'm going to say it's the best James Bond movie ever.
Speaking of which, we didn't say box office. I'll just throw that out
for
now.
For the box office.
So the box office for this so far has been, I guess it's been a surprise. I think it has. $78 million domestically, almost
awesome.
79. And it's still out. It's still collecting the dollars.
Yeah. Christmas is coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And international is $84 million. So it's a grand total of $163 million right now.
On a budget of?
On a budget of $40 million.
Done. That must have been salaries.
Oh,
yeah.
Most definitely.
It has to be.
And production design and stuff.
You got to figure that. You got to figure in marketing costs. So it probably cost 60 to 80 total, something like that,
that's
right?
That's awesome.
He probably bought his world-class Last Jedi crew. You know what I mean? That's what these guys do. It's kind of like when Sam Raimi went to do Drag Me to Hell.
He just bought the crew.
Now he has the Spider-Man crew. Yeah. He doesn't have the Evil Dead crew anymore. It's
right.
Spider-Man. So everything goes up in price and stuff.
So it is for itself a blockbuster.
Yeah,
it
I
is.
Would say.
Yeah,
for
totally.
Sure.
I would say,
totally.
Yeah, it's going to hit that 100 mil.
Yeah.
And that,
definitely.
Yeah, that level of profit. Well, can't wait for Knives Out 2.
So did you want to talk? Knives Out 2. It's going to be like somebody kills Marta.
So, about the continuing on the log line. So that means the lock-in. Really?
That's what I want to ask.
Yeah.
Yes.
The lock-in,
what is it?
Well, I personally think the lock-in is the part that happens in the flashback. So to me, the lock-in, so just to define what a lock-in is when all those things are set in the audience mind. So all those things that are in the log line, the hero, the goal, the obstacle, and the stakes. So as soon as you're able to write that log line and the audience knows, okay, this is a movie about a hero doing this to avoid this other thing to happen, that, in my opinion, is when the lock-in happens.
Yeah.
So what I would call the lock-in, and it's weird because it's in flashback. It's revealing to us what she already knows.
You're talking
about the birthday party. Specifically, you're talking about the birthday party.
The birthday
right?
party.
Yeah.
So there's that one part where she's starting to remember, describe, she's being pressed, And then we get to see the flashback of what happened when he took his own life to help her, and she snuck out and set everything up and did all the stuff. From that moment on, we know she has to cover this up, or her family's going to be deported,
or therefore, she goes to jail.
Therefore, we're in the lock-in. But okay. It happens all the way, like, it's about the 45-minute mark.
It's 40, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it's so
in
interesting. And then what else is weird
and
about
long,
it?
Right?
And long.
It's not just like a scene. It's
no, it's a sequence.
It's a
almost,
sequence
yeah.
of scenes. Yeah, and his, yeah. It's so interesting because normally we get the goal statement, the mission statement from the main character. In this instance, we're getting it from Harlan. Harlan's telling her what her goal is going to be. So right. It's really weird. It's in flashback, and we're being told from a dead guy what the goal and
but
the
it's
stakes.
Part of, mm-hmm. It's weird but appropriate. He's the writer.
Right.
We're being led by a movie that is essentially written by
it's
him.
It's meta. Yeah.
This is a movie written by Harlan
it's
about
meta.
Himself dying. And so, like, that's what it
yeah,
is,
so
right?
So I wanted to know, my question was, and I think you're right, Jamie. I was wondering if it started when they start questioning her, which happens way earlier, 25 minutes, but we don't know what her problem is.
We don't know. We don't know.
Yeah.
So then it's still that other log line of the movie. Until it's
okay.
That's
so,
in my opinion.
So it's a late. So it's
my,
a late.
My eyes.
Yeah, I think you're right. So it's like a 45-minute lock-in. It's
yeah.
Like and another so, late lock-in that
the,
works.
The right, reason yeah. the reason I'm interested in lock-in, sometimes act breaks are in the eye of the beholder, but lock breaks are usually something that almost isn't debatable. You know, I mean, in this case, it is in
yeah,
a weird sort
yeah.
of way. It's the definition of a lock-in sort of, because you could
right.
say, well, when did it really happen versus
right.
when?
It could be like the moment she wakes up, she's dealing with
she's
the problem.
With everything.
But I see it's when the audience knows. When the okay. audience is on board, this is my hero. I'm on this journey with
the How's
Marty going
to get back to the future?
Yeah.
How's Marta going to get back? Okay. for the anyone listening, what is a normal lock-in timeline?
Well, the books, you know, preach the 25%, and we've been on the show 25 out of 100.
You know. Okay.
We've been preaching on this show and showing time and time again that it could be 40 minutes, 42 yep. minutes, 45 minutes. This one's 45 minutes, and it doesn't necessarily have to be 25% ratio.
I think right. what the advantage this one has, and some people might be bored of this, some people not. For the detective movie, for that movie we just pitched, that one that you think you're coming to see, A Detective Investigates a Death, this movie jumps right into it.
Mm-hmm.
It's page two, and we're in. So it's moving fast for
yeah.
a detective movie.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it's not like your typical detective movie where you meet, I mean, when I say typical, I'm not even sure what I'm talking about, but where you meet the characters, and then the lights go out, and somebody gets shot.
Well, yeah.
And then
yeah.
and that's
it
the
doesn't
catalyst.
Flashback, hence, we're already, the deaths happened.
The deaths
where
happened.
Where we are
we're
in the present.
We're playing catch up.
It's,
we're catching
it's
up.
It's almost like
right.
Jaws, you know,
right,
the deaths
right.
happened,
yeah.
here we come.
And
the,
yeah.
Even in Jaws, it still takes a few minutes for them to find the body.
No, but in
it
this,
takes
it's
10
like,
minutes.
He's dead.
He's dead.
And now what?
They're right. already investigating.
Yeah.
So that's why I think this one gets away with it more. And that's the key with these slow lock-ins. Like, the instructive key is, let's say you have this slow burn movie. You have to really ask yourself, why are people turning the page? Why are they interested? This movie is tricking you by giving you the super fast paced detective movie, because it knows it can burn through that stuff early, because it's not really a detective movie.
Right.
It doesn't, a typical detective movie, those scenes of investigation and questioning would have to go on for another 2 hours.
Yeah, that's the fun of games.
Yeah.
And it happens right away.
Right.
Yeah.
So it jumps in there. So you're wondering, am I going to have to sit through this for 2 hours? Like, where is this
yeah.
going to go?
I thought the whole thing was going to be framed around the nonstop
interviews.
And
yeah. just yeah, Daniel Craig hitting the piano.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah.
But, so that's the magic. That's the cleverness. That's, in my opinion, that's why I really responded to this movie, because it gives you all of that you came for. But it does it, and then it gives you this other thing.
It even reveals the murderer and the quote unquote murderer, even though she didn't do it on purpose, like right away, like
right.
front end of it,
right.
which is usually you're trying to build to in one of these movies. You're trying to build
well,
to those
technically
answers.
It reveals that regardless of what she did, he is the murderer.
Right. Yeah.
like,
yeah.
yeah. It reveals two murderers
yeah,
right away.
Exactly.
So you're like, okay, well, covered.
Which was
yeah.
another great stroke, in my opinion, because then you're not spending, like what you do in a lot of these murder mystery movies, and I'm a big fan of the books. I've, you know, The 44 Rules of Amateur Sleuthing is basically a kid's spoof of these things.
Right,
I really love them. I've done a lot of things with detective stories. But what this one does that's cool is it lets you relax and not worry about who the killer is. You're like,
right.
oh, we know the killer.
Now
this isn't
we can
that.
Get into
and
it.
Then it brings it back to that. So if you almost bookend the the first act and the last act. It is that detective movie.
It becomes that.
But the fun and games, that middle two act section, the meat of the movie, is this other, it's more a Hitchcockian suspense thriller.
Yeah.
That's kind of a little fun and winky.
Watching it the second time too, I watched it twice. I saw it twice. So you saw it twice too, right?
Yeah, me too.
I was like, by the end of it, I was like, if you really think about it, it's really a movie about explaining why somebody would mess up the medications. That's it.
That's the
only question you have until the big reveal is, I'm like, yeah, explain to me why she did mess up the medication.
Right.
That's it.
Mean the second time around you were thinking that?
The whole time I was like, really? That's the question I need answered. Is the medication screw up? That's it.
Yeah.
Everything else, that will just lead to everything else. Yeah. But we want to talk about genre. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in particular, and this is kind of related to all this, and we've kind of already done it a little bit, but right. I was going to talk a little bit about Blake Snyder genres.
And who is Blake Snyder?
Who's that?
Tell us, Jamie.
Blake Snyder is the deceased writer of Save the Cat. Not to put a bummer on the Save the Cat, but and he wrote Save the Cat, a very popular book.
A series
of books, and a website, and ongoing,
I heard
all kinds
one's
of stuff.
The best.
Third one is the best.
Why is that, Jamie?
Why is the third one the best, Jamie?
Mostly because it shouts out a certain podcaster that may be on this podcast. So
what's it like, page 85 or something?
I don't know. That part I should.
Don't act like you don't know the page.
Actually, this is a true story. It's kind of hard to find where that page is. It's like mixed in this weird section about like writers outside of LA or something. I can never find my name in it to prove it, but I highlight it and then I put the book back in the shelf.
You go to Borders and just do it all day.
So Blake Snyder genres, most of Blake Snyder's book is the beat sheet, which is basically a template for outlining an overall screenplay, feature screenplay. But Blake, he also has this thing called genres, which really aren't genres like we think, like horror movie, comedy. These genres are more patterns of storytelling. So some of the ones he has are like the Golden Fleece. That'd be your typical quest movie, like a movie where you try to obtain something. Or he has, we
like
talked,
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings.
That's the Golden Fleece.
Star
movie.
Wars, mm-hmm. probably in some Star ways. Wars. If you were gonna,
so kind of a MacGuffin movie.
It's a MacGuffin movie. Golden Fleece are also sports movies, sometimes like win the championship, things like that. There's Monster in the House, which we talk about on like every other episode.
We have covered that shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of ones we never talk about, like institutionalized.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that.
What's an example of that?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is really on the nose
Stripes
of that.
In some ways, might be.
Really?
Yeah, Shawshank Redemption.
So like locked into an environment.
Locked into some kind of
structured,
social institution.
Yeah.
Is the villain.
I was trying to find
antagonism.
A word not to use it, institution, but
Green
it
Mile?
A system or something.
It's a system,
could be.
Right? Like social demons.
Yeah, yeah.
You take somebody out of the world and put them into a small world that they have to.
Yeah, something like that. And they either have to conform or rebel.
Right.
That's,
right.
That's institutional. Kind of the base. There's a whole bunch of other ones, but the two that this movie struck me as. There's one obvious one that I think if I said this and you were Save the Cat, you'd say, oh, it's obvious what this is. This is a whydunit movie.
Right.
And whydunit movies are typically about detectives. So that's where I started to
get
iffy about
it. Why
it's sold
as a whydunit.
Sold as a.
Because this isn't about a detective.
No.
So we sort of
yeah, right.
We sort of spoiled this already.
Right.
But so I lean towards, but I think most people would say this is obviously a whydunit. And it has elements of whydunit in it, and it's pretending to be at times. But I actually think it's probably more of a dude with a problem, which is one of the ones.
Dudette.
What's a more classic example of a dude with a problem?
So
movie?
Dude with a problem usually has an innocent hero, a sudden event happens, and then there's some kind of life or death battle that they have to go in. When I say life or death, put that in quotes. Life
I
and
instantly
death
thought of the
they're
big,
like
big
pulled
Lebowski.
In, they're pulled into something
that kind of works, right? He's innocent. Something happens. And
a lot of the thrillers are like Gone Girl and things like that.
Yeah.
Taken might be. Die Hard is a big dude with a problem.
Yes.
Okay.
Kind of story. I think that's what this is.
Because he didn't go there to deal with
that.
The terrorists.
Right.
You're thrown into something.
Yeah.
Right.
And usually it's the difference between an everyman and a superhero. Like sometimes when it's a superhero, it mixes it up. So it's
maybe
it's
Ant-Man.
It's an ordinary person. Some superheroes do have
kind of
with the problems.
Yeah.
But, you know. So anyway, I personally think this is a dude with a problem. But again, I'm more hearkening back to what we've already discussed a little bit.
Yeah.
It tricks you and makes you think it's a why done it, but then it's a
dude with a problem.
Just to clarify, dude with a problem is from the books. That's like
yes, it's
that's
a,
right.
It's
that's right.
And that's what makes it
assuming dude is non-gender conforming.
That's what the
yes, right,
yeah.
Of course, yeah.
That's the subversion. That's dude, what that's
now
why
I know why you thought it was Big Lebowski. I just realized.
Because you said dude with a problem, but he's thrust into a thing. I was like, instantly thinking Big Lebowski.
I was like, why is he thinking Big Lebowski? Yes,
it's a dude
it finally
with a
hits
problem.
Me 5 minutes later.
He needs his rug bag, man. Yeah.
Maybe that's where Blake got the term.
That's right. That's right.
Dude with a problem.
But
so anyway, that's all. It's just one of these things.
So you're saying they snuck a dude with a problem into a why done it.
Yeah. That's right.
And that's very instructive because that's when you're trying to tell a prototypical type of story, you can swap it and tell some other story
that's
within
right.
the genre
so,
expectation.
So imagine when Ryan Johnson, for all I know, has never heard of Blake Snyder or Sabre
right.
Cat, and you don't need to. You don't need to.
This stuff is
it's
instinctive.
Yeah. So imagine you're at the beginning of it and Ryan Johnson's sitting there. I'd love to do something with the Agatha Christie kind of thing. And he's thinking about it, and all Agatha Christie movies are wide on it. And he's like, wait, what if I inverted this? What if I made it more Hitchcock? What if I made it more dude with a problem? That's Hitchcock. And then, you know, you could see where you could play with this. You can do this with your own concepts. You might have a concept. You can try on these different flavors or different genres and just brainstorm. Like, what if it was this? What if it was that?
Yeah, like, what if it was so one of them is Genie in a Bottle?
Right.
So well, what if it's there's some magical thing that happens at the house?
Yeah.
And it's a problem that creates, you know, you play that magic right. story within the murder mystery.
You could see where this could be a monster in the house.
Exactly.
You could see all
that's
kinds
ready
of.
Ready or not.
I would think it
was, yeah, ready or not.
It's ready or not. Yeah, no, that's good.
That's
the also,
monster in a house version.
You can even like the quest, you could put the Golden Fleece movie?
Golden Fleece.
You could put that inside of an institution.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
With a monster.
Yeah.
There's three right there.
You can.
There's
you can.
Three right there. Yeah.
So honestly,
that's a really good point, Jamie.
That's what these genres are worth. That's how they're best used is when you're in the early concept phase, maybe right before you've done your outline, and you're just brainstorming what you can do with these kind of things. Figure out what your Blake Snyder genre is. There are some other tools that are similar to this. Like there's I can't remember the names of them, but there are some other archetypical story tools out there. Figure out what your story is and then go with it.
Yeah. I kind of, for some reason, I doubt Ryan Johnson is thinking of that at all. I think he's just writing for some reason.
Yeah, yeah.
We can't know. But
most people.
They probably just, yeah, he just has a
they
do.
Most right. people, it's instinctive, but this stuff can be taught. That's yeah. that's the point.
Sometimes it's
But
good.
It is a subversive script, so there is some intention to it.
Yeah.
To
that
subverting
conversation
that.
Had to happen in the construction.
And, right,
and
yeah.
So, sometimes the one value to these things, and honestly, if you never read a Save the Cat book, you can be a great writer. I mean, 100%. Sometimes
we're never leaning on that.
No,
yeah. ever. So,
sometimes there's value to have a vocabulary to put around your instincts.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of these books do. You already have it. Sometimes it just helps to have a vocabulary, a checklist. Just remind yourself of things you already know.
Yeah. Usually the books. I mean, a lot of people really hate on screenwriting instruction books, but for me. I've got a whole bookshelf full of them, and like what I look for in them is someone showing me something I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
giving it a term,
yep.
explaining it a little clearer, and then saying, here are all the ways you can use it, and I might not be using it in the ways that I'm currently using
mm-hmm.
it.
I always, mm-hmm. I feel like that's what you guys usually do for me mm-hmm. with this podcast.
Stuff that you've done before.
Or I know about,
sure.
and then you give it a name. It didn't. Right. In my brain, I was just like, it's just like when a person does this, but then you guys give it some term.
Yeah, yeah.
It's well, that's called a refrigerator. Oh,
right.
really? Oh, okay.
It's a Phillips head screwdriver versus a flathead screwdriver.
Right, exactly.
Sometimes you need the Phillips head, sometimes you need the flathead. Simple
and
as that.
With the genres, too, I read, after I saw this the second time, I just was skimming through a lot of reviews, and the amount of times people say the whodunit thing,
mm-hmm.
like it's a whodunit. They call it a whodunit. And then I told you guys before the podcast, a lot of people then corrected it. It's more of a
how done it. Yes. Mm-hmm. I like that phrasing.
Because the why is obviously money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we don't need that why. That's answered right away. So it's
right.
A lot of I saw more than one person call it a how done it. So I don't know.
I like it.
Yeah, that's interesting.
How done it.
They weren't like writing for the same website or anything. They were just like people collectively saying that.
It was a zeitgeist decision.
Yeah, why how done it. Right. We already talked about who's the protagonist, I feel like. It's Marta. Without question,
you know, and
right?
We didn't discuss this beforehand, and mm-hmm. I was curious if one of you was going to bring to the table a different opinion, and I'm glad we were in agreement.
I think there's, like, another movie. There's, like, two other movies.
LeBlanc.
There's LeBlanc's movie that we don't see.
Yeah.
And then there's Ransom's movie that we
Ransom's
might not
movie.
See.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, there's two other movies that we could have seen, but we saw Marta's, which... Yeah. Is the subversive choice to
but
show us,
but it's like
us,
the first
right?
time that we haven't really discussed at all. Some I thought we were going to come in here and Jamie's going to be like, it's going to be this. And I'm like,
No.
I think it's the Nazi kid.
It's the Nazi kid.
I was thinking about
his Twitter goals
yesterday. Like if Marta wasn't the protagonist and you did it from LeBlanc's, he was the protagonist. So mm-hmm. his point of view is the movie. I was like, it would be very hard to make her such a sincere and good character in our eyes.
Right.
Because we need to see her process of what she's doing to believe she's actually good.
Yeah.
She would come off bad.
She's kind of forced into the scenario.
Yeah.
Like she wouldn't
she's
have come up.
Great. Right.
Her lack of agency in the beginning actually works to her empathy.
Yep.
Because she would have rather done the right thing. It was almost forced upon her to do it this way.
Yeah.
And there were circumstances out of her control, like her mother and things, that she it was self-sacrificing for her to cover herself, her own complicity.
Yeah.
If we didn't see that stuff, she wouldn't be virtuous as she is in the end.
Absolutely.
Right.
Like, that's why it had to be that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a different movie. LeBlanc would be seeing a different movie.
Right.
You know? Even he had to be convinced of how virtuous
she was.
Would
it just been this weird, twisty, and turny thing where he labels her, like, you did it.
But then here's, like, what happened, and then we all flashback.
And then it goes to the next one.
Right.
But you didn't do it. You
right.
know, and it
right.
would, which we've seen in movies before.
That would have made
he would
it less...
be like a Sesame Street detective at that point. He'd just be like, ha-ha, and explain everything that
it's
happened.
Exactly like a Sesame Street.
right. Yeah, it would be really weird. But rooting influencers for Marta.
Yes.
What makes, like I said, virtuous. What makes us root for her?
So I've discuss this. Have we just done it on the Joker? Did we do it on any other ones?
One other one.
But Joker was the big rooting
influencer. One.
Yeah, because
it had so many.
It had so many. Yeah.
This is a guy named David S. Freeman. He has a list of 40 rooting interest techniques that he says if you front load, and these can continue through the whole story. They don't just stop.
They show up.
And they show up. I actually think they get piled on in the back end.
Yes.
Big time once we start really learning the truth. Mm-hmm. But
once we realize she's the protagonist.
Right. It takes 40 minutes before it's revealed her problem.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is before I get into this, one of the things I loved that was surprising is there's so much suspense built in what she's actually feeling. We don't get to hear her talk about the situation until she has that conversation with Ransom. And that's like 70 minutes in. Like, we don't really get to hear her just, like, you know, quote, pun intended, regurgitate, like, what she's feeling about the problem she's in until Ransom starts asking her questions, which is really unique and interesting because until then, we're just sort of relying on her expressions and reactions to things and flashbacks. But in the present, we don't get to hear her express, like, fears until, like, 80 minutes into the movie, which is really interesting.
It keeps us kind of baffled with her.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what kept me off balance and made me go, like, are we going to learn some? I was so glad that they didn't lie to us. I was so waiting for the thing that I experience a lot as a script consultant is a lot of amateur scripts that try to tell a story like this. They'll just lie. The protagonist is they'll pull something out of the air about the protagonist that the whole time she wasn't virtuous and she wasn't, you know, she wasn't worth rooting for and she had false motives the entire time. And I was really hoping
I was so scared the first time I saw that she was working with Ransom.
Right. They were going to pull it out. Yeah.
Right.
And that would have rung false based on what they showed us.
Right, right.
But I broke down, if you guys want me to, I broke down the rooting hymns.
I think we were expecting it.
First 10 pages. We'll just go
the first 10 pages. Rooting influences
and
by
what's
Jimmy
interesting
George,
about
a poem.
This, she only, yeah, a poem. She only talks a couple times. She only has like 5 lines in the first 10 minutes. So, like, this is all the stuff you learn about her. Like, with her not saying anything.
Well, her meekness is part of her rooting.
I know. It's
awesome. Yeah.
So, this guy, David S. Freeman, he has, like, a list of 40 of them, and all of these that I'm going to list are on that list. So, she wakes up from a nightmare. This rooting influencer is a character, has an emotional problem. We see immediately that she lives in a cramped apartment with her family, so that tells us that this is a character who gets by with little. The murder mystery show is on TV and it causes her to laugh and cry. So character shows pain. Marta tells her sister she can keep watching the murder mystery, and then the sister hugs her. So character is loving to her family. I took this line from the script. This is one line I noticed in the script. Ryan Johnson described this: Marta's shitty subcompact buzzes towards the Trombi house. I mean, that's perfect.
It goes into the plot later, so yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But by the way, we took a quick look at the script, but mostly we're analyzing this via the movie.
But what I was finding
I had like 10 pages of it.
Yeah. I went back specifically for these rooting influencers to the script because it's hard to keep tabs
while
you're watching.
In a theater especially.
Yeah, oh my God. There was no way I was going to get these.
Right. Yeah.
So what is that rooting influencer? A character gets by with little, again. She arrives at the house and the cop calls her help. She's an outsider, excluded outsider. Meg said she was her granddad's nurse, so character offers help to others.
With the excluded outsider, too, the racism.
The racism?
They keep they never say where she's from exactly.
And they keep messing it up. Right.
Which she doesn't respond to, but she obviously that's part of it.
Right, yeah.
That's
another great one.
Yeah.
Marta and Meg hug, and then they cry. Those are two rooting influencers. Character shows pain, and character is authentically warm to others. Linda, Jamie Lee Curtis, describes Marta to the investigators. She's a good girl. She's a hard worker. Her family's from Ecuador.
right.
That is a rooting influencer that we haven't discussed on previous episodes, where another character says something sympathetic about the main character.
Right.
So you feel rooting influence for them. And then they do it again with Don Johnson. Richard says Marta to the investigators. Harlan hired to help with medical needs, but really she's like part of the family. So that's another character saying something good about the main character, and the character helps others. So we got 13 rooting influencers in the first 10 pages, and she only has like 5 lines. So that's why we feel this deep empathy.
And then you're saying like later on, it's like
it's
a car crash
on.
Of
oh my
rooting
God,
influencers.
Because
then sympathy starts
coming
in
too,
right?
That's before we even know she has a problem.
Yeah. This is just her introduction. Yeah.
So it's really, it's a lot of craft. A lot of craft, and really subtle. It's all subtle. It doesn't feel like this stuff's being force-fed to you. You know what I mean?
You know what I was thinking, too? The pitch for this, the log line, I could see a hokey version, and they really don't go with this, about a woman who can't tell a lie, has to avoid the greatest detective. You know, you could use that as a high concept hook.
Right. Liar, liar. Yeah, it's like it's a very.
I was going to dive into that.
It's not on our outline, but I was going to ask you guys about that. What do you think about the plot device of her throwing up?
I think because what Jamie just said, because they didn't treat it like that, that it works.
Yeah, it's just a quirk almost. It's not like the whole movie. It's just like a small part that she has to deal with. One extra layer of obstacle for her to deal with.
And you tweeted about this.
About that part?
About the puking expectations of when a woman pukes on screen.
Oh,
subverts our expectations.
It subverts our expectations because they're puking on screen.
I wasn't even in relation to this.
Oh,
though.
It wasn't? No. That's so funny because I thought it was in relation to Knives Out. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I mean, okay, two things. One is what we just talked about a couple seconds ago. I was worried about when I first watched it, what the twist was going. And I thought that if she turned out to not be virtuous and this all was her actual intention, that the whole vomiting
fake.
Thing was going to be used as her actual ruse to be like, actually, I'm not lying.
It'd be like a verbal Kent moment.
Right, because I was like, why is everybody believing her throwing up?
I think that's intentional, too.
Right, and I was like, it's like a subversion of a subversion. I was like, because I was expecting something lame like that. Like, she was going to be like, I don't have to vomit at all. I was taking these pills the whole time. I am a nurse.
Yes.
Right, yeah, I thought that was going to be something like that. You know?
I have epicacasir upon me.
Other than that, the biggest criticism I have of the movie is that, I think if I had one, because I don't, I guess this is more of a tonal thing. It rang sillier to me than the movie itself.
Okay.
Just the fact that it was so on point and so like clockwork, I was like, eh.
Yeah.
I,
But the funny thing is,
it's not bad. I'm not saying it's bad, but that was the only thing that rang slightly false to me.
I view this movie as very silly. Like that's
It is. It wasn't that type of silly to me though. Yeah, that's a little different type of silly.
So it was tonal imbalance for you, not tonal imbalance.
Yeah,
for you.
Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is
yeah,
so funny.
Yeah.
We've had
which
this
is why I think
before.
I enjoyed it
have...
so much. Where I think some people,
I'm not saying I didn't like it.
Yeah, I'm not
that.
Saying you.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you didn't like it because of that, but I can see other people coming to this movie expecting it almost. The tone is done in such a way that it's not like uproarious laughter at it or anything. It's
not crazy
silly. But I found the whole thing hugely tongue-in-cheek, like almost like everybody was winking at me the whole time, yeah. Where I could see some people coming into this movie not winking, not thinking that, or not getting the wink.
Yeah.
And being like,
I got the
why
wink.
Are they
yeah.
laughing?
Yeah.
And
why
I'm also a huge fan of barfing. I'm like the guy that people send their barf videos to. So it's not like I don't like the barfing.
I sort of like,
you know.
I kind of, the setup and payoff of the barf in the end was the thing that did it.
No, that's great. I don't want that to be different. Right. It's just the fact that her regurgitation was so like clockwork with lying. I was like, man, it's a biological mental function. I was like, it's a little too on the nose.
But, by the way,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just a little too on target.
Yeah, we don't have these in our, I mean, it comes right out of a Jim Carrey movie in some ways.
But yes.
We didn't have this in there. There's some great setup and payoffs in this.
Yes.
The mug in the beginning,
the
I loved. I thought that was great.
The fact that at the beginning, the family's looking down at her.
Yeah, the visual.
At the end, she's
it's
looking
so
down
good.
At the family.
Yeah.
Just that weird knife thing in the background
there's
that's
the
used.
The knife clue. Yeah. I wrote
well,
down the clues in
the
reveals.
He says the...
can't tell a fake knife.
Yeah, the
from
fake
a
knife
plot.
From a real one.
That
one,
great.
Yeah. Done. Yeah.
That sort of even surprised me for like half a second, and then as it was sitting there, I was like, "Oh, it's gonna be the,
it's gonna be the fake knife.
It's gonna be the fake one." Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
While it's happening, but
lots
you love
good
it. It's like, great. Yeah. The puke. I was thinking when it happened. I'm shocked they didn't play this like as the liar hook.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm
mm-hmm.
glad that they didn't. I think that's why it doesn't feel.
You mean like it would be in the long line? A woman
yes,
who can't stop
puking. That's
saying.
What
yeah.
you're saying.
That's
yeah.
exactly it. I could see a version of this
that's
where that's the
high
log
concept
line,
pitch.
You know?
A woman who can't
that's
tell
like,
a lie.
That's the trailer where it's like all big red letters and everything smashing down.
A serial
down
killer who can't tell a lie must evade the murder. You know?
Well, she'd be talking with her girlfriend and then she'd be barfing and be like, see, you can't lie, girl. You know, like it'd be like terrible. Yeah. Right.
I'm going to write that movie when I go.
The girl who can't stop barfing. Yeah, that'd be my, I guess for me, it was slightly off tone because while the movie's tongue in cheek, it wasn't that. Which is silly in its own right. Mm-hmm. It didn't read to me as that type of silly. That's all. But it doesn't ruin the movie for me.
Gotcha.
Okay. I didn't want to like dog on the movie because of that.
You hate her. You're the reason Ryan Johnson can't make Star Wars.
I ruined the whole trilogy.
This movie was about you.
Yeah. I'm the Nazi kid.
You're
masturbating
the Nazi
in the bathroom. Right. Right. So I guess a good question. I feel like we were talking about this before it started, Jamie. Why don't they make Agatha Christie movies like this anymore? Why don't they make movies like this much anymore?
Well, just speaking on the mystery thing, because this is something I was thinking of. That log line is quite dull, you know, and that is the log line in most Agatha Christie movies. I saw what was the one that was out?
Murder on the Orient Express. I said I didn't see it.
Did you say it?
I didn't. I wanted to because Kenneth Branagh.
I love him.
It's hard. They're hard to execute, like, because our expectations. I think what's happened.
That didn't get the best reviews.
I didn't like it that much because it is. It's like the version of this, and I even saw them trying to fix Agatha Christie a little bit. They bring him in a little earlier.
Yeah.
They give him a little something, something. But then you have to lay out all these characters before the murder happens.
Right.
And then you have to hold off on any real reveal of the answer. So it becomes like a puzzle. And you have to play it fair and all these other things. So really hard movies to execute because it's just there's a lot of talking. So what's happened over the years is other genres have adopted the Agatha Christie. So, you know, Friday the 13th becomes an Agatha Christie. You know, who's doing it? While we're watching people get their heads chopped off and chainsawed. And so they almost are taking these movies and turning them into something else. They're putting the mystery and the style in other movies. But to just watch a pure version.
Like we get a Captain America movie with a mystery.
Exactly.
It has to be Captain America, though.
Exactly. Right.
We can't just have
and
this.
It has
under the guise of something else.
You
can have a big reveal in the end and the detective reveal. But
Honestly, just do it you think pure, there'd be sorry. More Batman movies like this.
Yeah. It's a no-brainer.
I think that's a debate. Everybody's wondering when the Batman detective movie.
Matt Reeves says that's what his movie's
cool.
going to be. Okay. So
that's exciting. I think my answer is the small screen has taken these over.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, House is that.
Yep. Yep.
House
I agree.
Is Holmes and Watson, House and Wilson every episode. And like
CSI,
I mean, all of the big small screen shows sort of revolve around. Even The Good Wife is often solving a mystery of the trial. You know what really happened.
There's probably plenty of indie movies that attempt this, whether it's good or bad. Yeah. They probably get lost in the shuffle.
Look, Murder, She Wrote did it for like 10 seasons or something, right. You know, before this. So.
And this would have been buried if it didn't have all these stars in it.
But it's just sort of like the same as when you get a low stakes, and by low stakes, I don't mean like they're not primal, but they're not, you know, epic in scale.
Thanos isn't going to wipe out
the
Earth
then
if she doesn't get her money.
Often, if it's a good script, it'll be just like get turned into placed in a show, and then
there are probably even ones now that do a whole season. That's one murder mystery.
Yeah, you know. I mean, that's probably what Fargo, and
maybe something.
The Fargo TV series.
I don't even
about.
Watch probably the shows that I'm going to mention.
I feel
like Riverdale or something.
Serialized television now are mysteries. Watchmen was a mystery,
and so I think that answers the question why we don't see things like this very often. And really, the only reason
in the
it
theater,
probably,
especially. Yeah, I mean, we're specifically talking about the theater, right?
Yeah,
the
theater
movie
going
theater
experience.
Right, yeah, that's
yeah,
just why
and it
the,
was
yeah.
fun to be like I saw people like. The first time I saw it, it was a packed theater. The second time, it wasn't. But the first time, I saw people like pointing at things on the screen that they noticed, you know, just having those visceral, like I see that clue right there. Mm-hmm. And just having this fun, it was a very crowd-pleasing movie in the first theater that I watched
right.
it with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say this movie doesn't do a pure Agatha Christie. You know, that's what we've been saying. It doesn't do it. So that's kind of why
he said his influences were that, but
yeah,
that but doesn't mean that he's not subverting them.
Right.
Yeah, he's not doing a pure Agatha Christie. Now, Murder on the Orient Express did do it. So if you want to see that, almost watch that and compare.
I mean, there's an original one too. It's not just the new one.
That's right.
You can watch either
the
version.
1970s.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It also has a star-studded cast
right,
as well.
Right.
It was kind of like what this is. In some ways, I'm sure that influenced him as well, because they used to do these star-studded murder mystery, like with all these famous people.
And if I had to guess, Kenneth Branagh is not trying to make a subversive Agatha Christie
movie. No, no.
It's straightforward, right?
There are some small touches, but it is pretty straightforward. And I think people that love it, they feel like this old warm hug from it, you know? But on the flip side, when I watch it, I'm like, you can't do this too often, because it is kind of... Yeah,
it's like showing The Godfather to a child now, and they're like, "This is so cliche."
Yeah, it's tricky.
Like, that's what happens with all the classics.
The classics, Agatha Christie's. She created the cliches. Yeah, so
yeah,
it can't seem
Count
fresh.
Of Monte Cristo. All the twists, it's like we've seen them, redone.
It's like John Carter of Mars. Like it seems hackish now.
It created all.
It created
things.
Everything,
yeah.
So it's not fair to. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But I think that other than the genre question, it's just a matter of it's a small thing.
Small stakes movie.
We don't see it.
We don't go to the movies for that anymore, unfortunately.
I said to Jamie while you were in the bathroom, I was like, it felt weird watching people just talking in the theater. Because I don't go to the movie theater as much as I used to.
Right.
So like just seeing people just
talking.
It's
almost like watching an art house movie.
Yeah, but
you
it's
know,
not because
the
there's a bunch of big
theater.
Stars.
Yeah.
It's not. It's like, it felt like it's this like smaller
thing. I love
thing.
That about it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's great. It's kind of, it's refreshing these days.
Refreshing.
Right. You wrote down on here the importance of setting up suspects and their movies.
Yes.
Explain this to
motives.
Me. Motives.
I think that the strength...
Sorry, it's early.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's, yeah. I think the strength of this movie is that basically we're given a series of villains' plans at the front. By front-loading that interrogation and setting them up as murder suspects, then when we learn that they didn't do it, we understand why they might like harm Marta or sort of try to foil Marta. So suddenly the thing that made them perfect suspects for murder continues on and makes them perfect suspects for doing something to like harm our
to
main
her,
character.
Yeah.
And I think that it's like it was a really clever way to sort of give us all these possible villains by the end.
Well, they're not murderers, but we find out they'll definitely deport it, son of a bitch, right?
Right, But I think
it was setting up their ruthlessness.
That's what I mean. Yeah, we get a bunch of villains' plans at the front end, but it doesn't treat it that way at all.
No.
I thought it was very clever.
That's what's interesting structurally, because we get the lock in. You get like a midpoint where the will is read. And then so that raises the stakes because now all the knives are out for her.
Right.
And then you get kind of the all is lost where she admits her thing. And it's a really fun, as far as the way it's written, it's really cool structure. It has some great, hits the beats really in a cool way.
And the premise folds in on itself. It's that thing. Jamie, you want to explain that? And then I'll give an example from this.
So we talk about a lot of times when you have a premise, there are some obvious things that come with the premise that are like, I'm trying to think of some examples here. What are some good premise examples? I don't know. I can't think of
any. For this one, an example, when he's dead, she comes into the house, Marta comes into the house, and they're all sort of mourning after the funeral happened, and they're having their conversation, and we know that the memorial and the will reading is later tonight. Jamie Lee Curtis says one-off line that sort of sets up a ticking clock for that. Mm-hmm. They all come to her, and they say, "We've been talking, Marta, and we've decided that we're going to take care of you, that we're going to, whatever we inherit, no matter what, you can count on us. We're going to take care of you." And then once she inherits it, now in the end of the second act, they're all coming to her, like basically begging for her to take care of them.
Right. Yeah.
It's like inversion. A great example of an inversion.
You kind of reverse
of
things. Yeah. You definitely, you can just kind of twist and turn the different ways you use
it. Right. And it only works because of that initial, you know, promise of the premise, and then the reversal. That's why it's so impactful. I just thought that was a very clever.
The one other thing I was thinking of that I really, really impressed me with this too is kind of twist endings. This one hides the fact that there's ever going to be a twist ending. And I think that's the key with twist endings. You have to give us a movie that's good enough that it would work without the twist ending. Like, let's say,
like if she just accidentally messed up.
If she decided,
it's still a movie. It's still a viable movie.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
A lot of times I'll see screenplays that only are interesting because of this. It's like wasting time. Twist ending. So this movie is an excellent example of a movie where twist ending works. And it's because the movie without the twist ending works.
I like that.
Yeah. So I don't know what my finale would be to this movie if there wasn't a twist ending. Somehow
she would have to go to jail.
Yeah. I don't know.
Because she did lie to the police.
You have to come up with another satisfying ending.
Yeah.
But
it would be her hiring lawyers to stay out of jail.
Yeah, with the money.
With the money. Yeah. That would be it.
I think you could. I think there's a way you could figure it out. Or let's say the detective covered up for her because he realized she was kind and didn't mean to do something. You'd have to come up with some kind of
That would be it. Yeah, LeBlanc realizes she's a virtuous person that didn't mean to do it.
And he says, "I know you got a kind heart.
He saved her the maid's life, and he'd be like, "Okay, this was all a mistake. That's all it is."
Yeah.
You know,
that could be one.
Like, I don't know if this would go into this section I was talking, but the one thing that this movie didn't give me, which I thought I was walking into, which was I thought it was going to be a movie about all of them. Like, I guess as far as motives this works, I thought it was going to be a movie about all of them kissing their father's ass to try to get the fortune. Instead, it's a movie about them basically, you know, giving him the middle finger and saying, "How dare you not help me?" Which I thought was interesting.
After
like, at
fact.
No point did this have, like, the family's so rotten, they don't even grovel to the person that has the power.
Yeah.
That's how nasty they are.
There's a television show called Succession that's kind of about that.
Yeah.
That's
pretty much
all it's about.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it yet.
You guys, you might not remember. There's a Michael J. Fox movie called Greedy.
I haven't.
I do remember Secret of My Success, the number two movie of whatever year that was.
Right. Yeah. Well, that was just a Michael J. Fox movie about, basically, in this movie, if the old man was dying and everyone knew and they're all rotten, but they all start to kiss his ass, they'll do anything. That movie.
Okay.
I thought I was kind of walking into that movie, and it's like completely the opposite. Like, I thought the marketing kind of sold me. I was like, on that. Like, they're going to find out that he's dying, and they're going to all start kissing his ass, and then something's going to happen.
Gotcha. But
yeah, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
So it subverted my weird expectation of that.
I was just the entire... I picked up so many things the second time because I was so thrown by what the movie was the first time compared to what I came in based on the marketing. I wanted to... So I liked what you said about why the twist works, because it works on it, even if there isn't a twist, that it works. Mm-hmm. But
it's
I think it's not necessary for it to be sad. That's interesting.
I have a question about that, but go ahead.
I think it does two things really well. Oddly enough, even though we don't see these types of movies in the movies a lot, I get submitted a lot of these types of scripts. Mm-hmm, just your plain old murder mysteries. I see these.
They're really
a lot.
Filmable.
I probably consulted on like 30 of these.
I think it's a screenwriter thing, writer thing.
One location type of deal. Yeah.
And what those do that this doesn't, and I'm not calling out any individual clients, often you get, I think it's, first of all, you don't get plausible misdirection. And this has plausible misdirection. And like what I mean by that is everybody's calling out Ransom before we meet him. Everybody's saying, well, he's the black sheep of the family, and basically talking shit on him before we even meet him. And oddly enough, that puts him like in our favor. Like we kind of are like, it kind of makes you go like, well, is he a bad guy, or is the family just a bunch of assholes? You know what I mean? So before we even meet him, we're not even sure if we should like him or not like him. And then the detectives, when they're going over...
Are you praising the ambiguity of, of Ransom?
But okay. I'm saying it's done so... It's like a rooting influencer. You know what I mean? They sort of give you these rooting influencers for Ransom before we even
meet him.
And they
also show how his family's a bunch of nasty
assholes.
That's
what I mean. Right, and so it sort of makes him like the underdog, right? Of all these villains, maybe he is good, right? And then when the detectives are going over all of their things they discuss, they say, we know Ransom didn't do it because he wasn't here. So then you, oh, okay. That's another good misdirection. You go, maybe he
so
didn't do it.
That's actually what I wanted to ask. Are you still got more stuff?
Yeah. I was just calling.
Oh, I want to say the
keep going.
I had this too, and I read it in several people's tweets and reviews. The one thing a lot of people complained about was they saw it from a mile away, because that what you just said, the detective's literally saying he didn't do it. It's like a lot of people are like, well, it's him. Like the, you know what
so,
I mean?
So
like
they are, at this point, I think that's ballsy.
It's weird that they were already assuming the movie was subversive, and then they're like, well, if they're gonna say that, then it's obviously this, and then it was. You know what I mean?
I thought that it was
in the effort of writing twist endings.
I didn't want to like come out here and say I like solved it all, but I did. But what I appreciated was I solved it all, and then the movie did enough to make me question my decision.
So you're saying there was a, oh, maybe I'm not right.
I'm saying it's consistently misdirects in a way that I feel is very satisfying. That's what I was going through all the misdirection.
It still works even if I did solve it.
Yeah.
You know, it's still entertaining.
That's kind of my point.
That's why I wanted to talk
the
about.
The whole movie, I'm not sitting there saying who did it. I'm not even thinking about that to the back half of the movie.
Right.
So, you know, it works without that twist ending. And unfortunately, no matter what you do in that scenario, half the people are going to get it, half the people aren't.
Right.
It's just the nature.
And some people live and die by, like, the ending of a movie. They're like, I saw it, so the whole movie's
bunk. So then they don't.
And then it's weird.
But I think this movie subverts. That's what I like about this movie, that doesn't even matter too much. That's not a big deal. It's just like a tack on to give you a finale.
I enjoyed it more the second time, and I know who did it.
Yeah. Because you appreciate the craft.
Yeah.
And that's what I was going through all the mis... I was, like, showing all the misdirection. Because, like, okay, for me, yes. When the neuroloxine or whatever you say it was missing, I was like, okay, someone stole that. And then when Ransom, they piled on all the stuff on the Ransom, I was like, I think it's Ransom, and I think he stole it.
Also, not in the script, but the actual execution goes a long way to prove that she was not acting. About it missing.
Right.
Like, she's crying. She's literally in tears.
Right.
Right, yeah.
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 But, so I was praising, there's, like, so much misdirection. Like, when Ransom arrives and they're about to go do the will, they continue to treat him like shit. Like, and he's funny, right? Like, he's like, eat shit. Right. And he's, once again, you're kind of like, maybe he's not the bad guy. Maybe I'm wrong, you know? And then when the family swarms Marta, who's the one person who comes to her aid? Ransom. Right. And he doesn't gaslight her. He listens to her feelings, and he's the first person in the whole movie who will listen to her fears, and he's like comforting her. And I just was,
oddly, the first moment I started, that's when I was like, okay, he did it. That's for me when I was like, all right, this guy did it. He's obviously guilty.
But I just thought it did so much. It put so much effort in it, but it never lied, because like everything, if you go through the lines, everything that's coming out of his mouth is pretty much honest. We just get new context to it when we learn the reality. Like when he's like talking about the moment Harlan said that he was out of the will, he said, I could have killed him. And he's like, I went into my car and I had clarity and I decided I'm gonna have to fend for myself. That's not a lie.
No.
Like, that's honest.
That's what he did.
Yeah.
He fended for himself.
Yeah. There's a line that Harlan says that I feel like is like what Rian Johnson thinks about murder mysteries, which is, don't lie, tell fragments of the truth. That's what Harlan says. And that's what this movie is. It never lies to us. It only just tells us little pieces. Yeah. I just appreciate it. I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did really bank on her knowing the viscosity and tint of those medicines,
of the
though.
Bottles.
Like, he really banked on that knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's plausible.
That's fine. I'm not saying I don't like it for that reason, but that was a heavy bank.
It was the bottles and the puking that you were like, eh.
The plot, I mean, this is what I said earlier.
If it was slightly sillier, I would have been like, all right.
This is why I think it was silly. I think the actual murder plot in this movie is a little bit bonkers. It's a stretch. It wouldn't fly in a Murder, She Wrote episode, but it flies in this movie. You know,
there is part of me, too, that's like, what you said, Jamie, like, if this movie just ended without Ransom doing anything, it would be hilarious that no one murdered him. It was just a fuck up.
Yeah.
And the movie we're watching is literally just a bunch of horrible people in a terrible situation.
Which like, totally movie, rings true.
That movie, it is true, but that movie also speaks to me that there was no villain. It's just it's just a series of unfortunate events, you know? Yep. That's it.
Which
yeah.
is very British, which is what these are inspired by, the haves and the have-nots, and misunderstandings.
I think there being a villain makes it way more marketable, though, and makes it a movie that people are
Gives you a bigger ending.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit more too subversive to not have a villain.
Yeah.
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 But anything else we want to say? Well, how did you guys like this movie? Like I feel like we don't address this enough on the podcast.
When I watched it, I enjoyed it probably more than anything I've seen so far this year.
You messaged us and said something specific.
Because of the screenwriting aspects, because of the subversion and stuff like that. I could see why that might either limit it, much like Last Jedi or whatever, or cause people not to like it.
Yeah.
But for me, going into a movie that I'm not really high expectations and seeing this kind of thing and seeing the subversion, showing me something new and very effective and very crafty. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Well, you said it was your favorite movie of the
year. It is. It's the most fun I've had watching a movie so far this year.
It's like ringing out. I'm trying to ring this out of you, Jamie.
So far this year, this is probably the one. I can't remember one I enjoyed more
than watching this.
Yeah, I always have a bad memory of like what I saw back in January, February, March. That's why I'm hedging.
I always need to,
like,
I need to look at a list.
Is the same year as Endgame.
Oh yeah, that's right. Maybe it is.
Well, the world sucks. Years feel like decades now. So,
and I really,
And
I'd be hard pressed to put this ahead of Endgame, but that's kind of where I forget. Like, oh yeah, that's right, I saw that.
Putting them in even the remotely same category is stupid.
Apples and oranges. I forget how many.
Yeah, right.
Endgame, I had expectations for, and it met them. This movie I had no expectations for and exceeded them or something. So I don't know.
I might not have even seen this in theaters had we not done this.
I'm so glad we did it.
I'm so glad we did.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. I don't know if I didn't love it as much as you did, but it was definitely a really nice surprise.
You just don't like the puking. I get it.
But I love puking. I really want to stress.
I love how he's very defensive about his love of puking. He wants to make that clear.
In my friend circles, I'm known for how much I love puking.
Bob's the puke guy.
I am the puke guy. So I'm just saying, in the face of that.
Too artsy for puking. I get it.
Right. But also, before we close, I just want to say, like, something we never also talk about is that our enjoyment is not, at least my personally, is not just predicated upon script.
The craft of the screen.
Well, just it's not just that. Like, I love movies with bad scripts, and
I hate movies.
I'm not.
There are movies that are well constructed that they're just not funny to us or interesting or whatever.
Which
it
I think
happens.
Says something about what we do with our show. Is sometimes we'll talk about a script or a movie and we'll seem to praise it the whole time, but all of us are kind of like, yeah, it was fine.
It was fine.
But the actual episode might be like, I would say like our Joker episode was overtly positive.
Yes.
But all of us are like, Joker's fine.
Fine.
Like, we don't hate it. We're just like, it came off like we were like, fucking A, the Joker. and that's not, so like in the future that I just
it
wanted to get
well
that
crafted,
out there.
Though.
Yeah. I just wanted to get that out there for our tone.
Okay.
What we're saying. We're like, we're talking about craft. We're not exactly always talking about our review of the movie.
Yeah.
And I think that's it for right now for Knives Out, right, guys?
That's it.
Yeah.
So Jamie's not plugging his movies on Hulu that are Christmas themed, and this is
that's right.
Plug those.
Yeah. So let's see, on Hulu you can watch both Santa Hunters and Tiny Christmas, but they're also both on Nickelodeon and the Nickelodeon channels almost every day the last week of Christmas. I know they're
awesome.
Like Christmas Eve, Christmas Day. So they're kids' movies. So if you have kids or something, or you just want to check them out, Santa Hunters, which I think is 2014, 2015, something like that, and then Tiny Christmas, which was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, watch them, and if you want to take Jamie down, send us all your feedback.
And we have an email address.
Absolutely.
We've gotten like 6 emails in the history of this podcast, writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com. You got questions, comments, whatever.
Or tweet us.
Yep.
You know, please. Just get us some internet thing. Find us. It doesn't matter. Yeah. And that's it. I think that's everything, guys. All
Thanks
right.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Bye.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.